we put it on our welcome letter after match when we know exactly which students are coming to us. And then we talk about it during orientation. So just making sure that people understand how to access accommodations and that we are a welcoming environment. And we're partnering with the ACGME, which is the Accreditation Council for GME, to work on some resources that nationally everyone could use. And so I think if I wasn't in this position, you know, I wouldn't be able to have that influence. So it's kind of like using your power for good and not evil. So that's what I'm trying to do, at least with disability. And I don't want it at the exclusion of other DEI efforts. It's additive. It's not in place of. But I think that disability gets sort of forgotten. So we make sure that we do not forget disability.
Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor. I'm your host, Stephanie Moss, navigating life as a patient and a future MD. Walk alongside me as I reflect on the challenges and lessons I have learned undergoing medical school with invisible disabilities. Join me as I interview other doctors, students, and healthcare workers on their own journeys. Listen to their unique stories on how they have balanced their health while caring for others in the health profession. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Anne Matzman, who is a professor of emergency medicine in the Department of Emergency Medicine in Wayne State University School of Medicine. She serves as the vice chair of education for the department and also as the associate dean of the graduate medical education for the university. She completed her undergraduate degree in mathematics at the University of Michigan, completed medical school at George Washington University, and then completed an emergency medicine residency at St. John Hospital and Medical Center in Detroit. She has worked clinically in Detroit since completing residency and currently practices at Sinai Grace and Detroit Receiving Hospitals. Her professional interests include medical education and physician wellness. Welcome, Dr. Missman.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on this podcast. I'm really excited.
Yes, thank you. I'm here to learn about you, hear your stories. So tell me a little bit about your background and your journey to medicine to date.
Sure. So I'm born and raised in Metro Detroit. I've been here other than medical school and undergrad. I've lived in Metro Detroit my entire life. My parents, my dad's a PhD. My mom is an MD. She went to Northwestern for residency in OBGYN in the 70s, which was very cool because women were not very common in any sort of surgical field. She even became a chief resident. So she was super awesome. During her residency, she had an episode, I think, of vertigo and was ultimately diagnosed with MS as a resident. So she took a job in Metro Detroit, and that's how my parents ended up out here. And her career was cut extremely short. I think she practiced clinically as an attending for maybe 10 years or so. And then became completely wheelchair bound. So by the time I was about 6 years old, she was 100% wheelchair bound. So that was sort of the household I grew up in. Obviously, she could not practice anymore at that point. So anyway, so I grew up in Metro Detroit. As you said, I went to Michigan and then George Washington. And then for family reasons, came back home and did my training here. And I've been in Detroit ever since I started residency in 2008. So I've been here in emergency medicine for about 16 years now. When I was in high school, I was having some numbness of my right foot. I was a junior in high school. I actually went to boarding school to study the piano. So I went to Interlochen Arts Academy, which is in Northern Michigan, and kind of had a feeling like I knew what the diagnosis was going to be. And came home and saw a neurologist and had an MRI and was diagnosed with MS when I was 16. So that was 1999. And so we're coming up on the March 1st will be the 25-year anniversary of the diagnosis. So I've been dealing with it since high school.
Oh my goodness. I can't imagine so young. That does seem younger than when it's normally diagnosed. Did that change your aspirations at all going into, if you're in high school at that point, did it change kind of what you thought your future career was going to be?
Yeah, so certainly it gave me a lot of pause because I looked, you know, the one example I had to look at was my mom. And she, the time between diagnosis and being completely wheelchair bound for her was, you know, under 15 years. And so if you're 16 years old and you're thinking, well, if we extrapolate that, then I would be in a wheelchair by the time I'm 31. So I would never even really be able to practice medicine independently. but she also did not have access, because they didn't exist, to any disease modulating therapies. Obviously I did. I'm also very stubborn. So, you know, I'm not going to let some like possibility of something bad happening keep me from doing what I want. So yes, I thought about it. No, I didn't hesitate for a second. I knew in high school, even at the time that I was diagnosed, I was fairly certain that I wanted to go to medical school. So it didn't stop me.
I love that perseverance. And you know what? That term stubbornness has actually been a common theme that I've been hearing. I definitely been called stubborn, and I can associate with that. It definitely seems like an ingredient for success a little bit that you need to have. What was that transition like then to going into college?
The thing is that my family is very, very private with medical information. So, you know, and I, at that point, had invisible symptoms. I had invisible symptoms for 20 years. And so I did not tell anybody. Like I said, I was in boarding school, so I had a roommate. After I was diagnosed, I had to come home for a week and get IV steroids. And I just kind of disappeared. You know, my teachers knew that I had to leave. Even they didn't know why exactly, but it became this like very tightly guarded secret. So it was just something I kind of dealt with on my own. In terms of like the transition from high school to college, or even college to medical school, it was just something I was sort of dealing with internally, and not like there wasn't like, you know, some big shift where I was transitioning from, you know, having to tell this whole new group of friends or anything like that, because I just didn't do that.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure the stigma in society kind of kept your secrets close-knit. Was it hard to keep the secret or easy?
I would say it was easy most of the time. At the time that I was in high school and college, I was on a medication called Betaseron, where I had to get a shot every other day. And you're going to think this is ridiculous, but I was kind of like, didn't want to give it to myself, which in retrospect is insane, but I just didn't. And I had access to the student health care at the university and at my high school. So I went there 3 times a week. I mean, all the nurses knew me. I just walked in and I mixed up the shot, because you have to, there are a couple of vials you have to mix together, and then they would give me the shot and I would walk out. So that was kind of interesting. Like that, nobody knew about like that I was going to student health 3 times a week to get a shot. I just kind of did that on my own. Never ran into anybody, surprisingly. So yeah, other than that, like, you know, everything else was pretty normal. Once the medication, they developed an auto injector where you could just drop it into this little device and then give yourself the shot. So once I got an auto injector, I stopped doing that whole rigmarole and was able to do it myself. And so then that even took that part out of the equation. The only time it got kind of a hard secret to keep is that Betaseron at the time, I'm not sure if it still is, had to be refrigerated. And so, you know, it's college, people are going in the fridge, grabbing a beer, and they're like, what's this box of medicine? So I tried to kind of like keep it hidden in the back behind milk and things that wouldn't interest people at a party. And oddly enough, no one asked, at least not to my face. Maybe they looked it up some other time, but nobody said anything.
It reminds me a lot of like insulin and individuals who have to like give themselves shots and keep it in the fridge. Did you ever have any friends besides like your family, any other friends that also had health conditions or that you did share with?
I had, I would say, by the time I graduated college, maybe 4 friends, if that knew that I had MS. And I didn't really particularly have friends that had other like serious medical conditions that I knew of.
I actually recently had a question about how to disclose to friends. Do you have any recommendations for that?
It's an interesting process, because especially if it's something you've been keeping to yourself for a while, I was kind of surprised that people could be almost offended, like, well, you didn't trust me to tell me this before. And it's sort of a weird thing. You don't, when you meet a new person, you don't lead with your medical history. You don't say, oh, hey, nice to meet you. By the way, I have this disease. But eventually, if you become close with that person, like, what is the timeline? Is it a month into the friendship? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? So you have to trust the person. So it, I don't know. I think it's very individual. I was a little surprised that some people's reactions were more about themselves and that their feelings were maybe hurt and less, a little bit less like, oh my gosh, please tell me more, you know, something like that. So you sort of have to be prepared. I think that you cannot predict what reaction you're going to get from people.
That is such an interesting reaction, but I can kind of see that at some point, kind of like the trust of, wait, we're friends. I thought you trust me with a secret, but for some reason, health is different. We treat it differently, even with our own friends. Okay. So tell me, so you were in college. How did the transition to medical school go? I'm guessing you didn't disclose is what I'm hearing too.
I didn't disclose in med school. I didn't disclose in residency. I didn't disclose at my first job. I didn't disclose at my second job. It took a very, very long time before I felt comfortable doing that. So yeah, going to med school was great. I was just so happy to be there. And I really loved George Washington for medical school. And like I said, I still had invisible symptoms. I didn't have mobility issues yet. So it was a very, very easy secret to keep.
Did you ever need to request accommodations? Or I know you mentioned like going when you were younger, you had to like go to health appointments and going to the nurse. Did you have anything like that that you requested or that you needed, even though it was invisible?
No, I did not ever in med school residency request accommodations. To convey how deeply kept this secret was, the only example I can give is that even during residency, it happened a couple times where I had flares and I needed to get IV steroids for either 3 to 5 days. And this is an outpatient thing, you know, you can go in, get your infusion and leave. And I would schedule my steroid infusion, you know, emergency medicine is shift work. And so I would have my appointment either right before or right after a shift. And they would keep the IV in. And I would, even if it was summertime, I would just wear long sleeves at my shift and like never like, and I feel bad. This is not because I didn't think my program could handle it or because my program director was not going to be supportive. She's fantastic. It just didn't seem relevant. And if I could do it without asking for anything from anybody or having to talk to anybody about it, then I was just going to do it that way. I see now that's not necessarily the healthiest way to deal with it. But at the time, you know, that was what worked for me.
I'm glad you brought up the flares because I feel like that is, even with my own, that I have an invisible disability, it's flares that are the challenges of unpredictable or like, how do you go about if it is a secret or if you do need to go to medical appointments? So yeah, those are definitely the hard ones. Do you regret not disclosing earlier for your own experience?
I regret my reasons for not disclosing. I regret that, quite honestly, like now that I've grown up a little bit, you know, I have a much better understanding of mental health and the importance of people seeing a therapist. I wish I had at least talked to a professional about why am I so scared to disclose this? Like what am I holding on to that I think is going to be harmful or make me vulnerable? That's what I regret. I don't regret not disclosing. I don't think it would have, you know, it wouldn't have mattered really one way or another because I didn't need significant accommodations, and accommodations I needed, I was able to sort of create for myself. But I do think that if someone is holding on to this secret, you know, that's usually wrapped in shame, maybe guilt. And so I wish I hadn't felt that way for so long.
Fear, shame, guilt, those are very powerful emotions and can really take over ourselves. And I'm glad you mentioned mental health. Would you like to discuss how it did impact you holding that secret? Or you kind of talked about that a little bit, but is there anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I guess just, you know, at the time, I wouldn't have been able to verbalize, like, why do you not want to share this with people? And it took me going and talking to a professional and kind of understanding my underlying motivation for not wanting to share this information. And so I think it was 2020, I finally just ripped off the Band-Aid and I sent an email to my entire department, all of the residents, all of the faculty, all of the clinicians, and just said, like, hey, here's this bit of information. At that point, I have a very noticeable limp now. It was pretty noticeable, but not as noticeable as it is now. And I was just tired of like making up stories and be like, oh, I hurt my knee playing lacrosse in college. Like at that point, it was starting to be like, I'm a liar. Like I'm lying to all these people. And just kind of working through it with my husband and with a therapist and just deciding, like, what is it that we're so scared of here? And then sort of the outpouring after that email of support was wonderful.
That's amazing to hear. What made you kind of do that form of disclosure specifically?
I didn't want to have to do it over and over and over in person. I didn't want to have to decide, well, which group of people do I tell first? Like, I just didn't want to do it a million times. And so as impersonal as it might have seemed, and I explained that in my email, like, I understand this maybe not the most personal way to tell people this information, but I hope people understood that, like, I just didn't want to say it. We have 80 residents and 100, you know, faculty members and clinicians that's a lot of times to have to tell that story over and over versus just kind of getting it done all at once. And we're ER people, like ER, we want to, like, now, right now, let's just get the problem dealt with and move on.
Yes, no, I resonate with that. I think that's, once I realize how it does get when it's repetitive and it does bring up a little bit of trauma every single time you have to explain it over and over. And I did a similar thing when I first disclosed to my entire class. I did a group chat to all 140 people of my classmates. I was like, here it is. It was the same kind of thought. I was like, I was tired of the shame. I didn't want to beat around the bush and just get it out there. And I did it. Now move on. I'm so glad to hear how positive they received it. Do you want to talk more about, were you expecting such a positive feedback?
I wasn't expecting negative feedback. So yes, I was figuring a few people would respond, but I guess the number of people and people that I didn't really think I had, like, that knew me very well, even reached out. And even some people said, I'm glad you told me that my mom has MS or my cousin, or, you know, like, there are people that could kind of relate to what was going on that I didn't know that about them. So it was really cool, cool experience at the end.
I feel like that is another common thread. Once you disclose, it seems that people seem more trusting to disclose too. Have you noticed any change on, like, interacting with patients, or did you ever disclose to patients?
I very seldom disclose to patients unless it's relevant. I would say the one thing that I have found so startling, and not in a good way, is how quickly people, perfect strangers, like when I'm at work or not at work. I mean, it just happened last night where a security guard was like, why are you limping? And like in a tone of voice that wasn't like, oh my gosh, are you okay? Why are you? It was like, it was just very matter of fact. Why are you limping? And I said, because I have MS. And then this is universal. And they get a look on their face. They're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I thought maybe you hurt your knee or twisted your ankle. But so then it's like, you have to do this. I do this every day where, you know, I can't know every patient. I can't know every nurse. I can't know every security guard. So I have to explain every day what this limp is. And that gets kind of annoying. And I don't want to be bothered, you know, having to explain myself all the time. But I guess the point of this is, I thought it's very interesting that people think they have the right to know because they can see the thing. But like, we would never do that with other, can you imagine saying to a perfect stranger, why do you have that rash? Why are you, what, like, you just wouldn't do that, but for some reason people think this limp is like something that they have every right to know, like why it's there.
That's such an interesting thought. I never thought about it that way. Yeah. Is it like usually a physical thing of the, like a movement that is more common for people to ask about? Or, because I'm just thinking like when someone feels sad or something, people don't like ask why it's sad, but
yeah,
that is an interesting thought process. Now, since you kept it in for so long, did you notice it affect, or at least did you have any lessons that from your own experience being in the healthcare field or seeing your mother in through the illness, did you bring any of that? Were there any positive attributes or lessons that you learned that you were able to use when you were then as a provider yourself?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, I would not be I don't think I'd be a very good doctor. If I had a, first of all, I probably wouldn't even go into medicine if my mom was healthy. I just think I wouldn't have. But yeah, having, you know, just being able to see what it's like taking care of somebody that has a significant illness, watching her frustration, then watching my own frustration. I mean, it makes you just a much more compassionate physician to the patients. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to hear more. That is one of the things that I'm trying to showcase is how does having health conditions and providers, like how does that diverse in perspective bring as a positive attribute to patient care and to the healthcare field? Anything else?
So there's lots of different things. Some examples I can think of is just patients that have difficulty obtaining their medications. You know, their insurance is giving them the runaround, or it's expensive, or they have to use a specialty pharmacy. I don't think if you haven't been through that, if you haven't been through the frustration, and I was, you know, as a doctor, I had a very difficult time getting my medications. And I knew exactly how to navigate things. I knew what words to say. I knew what paperwork needed to be done. And there were many times when I had trouble getting, you know, pre-authorizations for my medications, which I had to do every single year, as if the MS is going to get cured. Just how some patients would be like, you know what? Forget it. The system does not care about me. They're putting up too many obstacles. So I'm not, you know, I'm done. And so I think it'd be easy to write off those patients and say, like, well, you're not taking care of yourself, or you don't understand the severity of your condition. And, you know, it's generally not that. It's usually some other reason. And then even just there have been moments where I've taken care of patients with MS. And so that's an obvious connection. But I had a patient, a pediatric patient, a few weeks ago, and he fell, and he has CP, and he has a brace on his leg. And I wear a somewhat similar brace on my leg when I work. And so, you know, I could tell he was just kind of like uncomfortable. And I was like, oh, I like your brace. Look at mine. And I was able to, like, you know, pull up my scrub leg and show him my brace, and like, just to see him be a little bit more comfortable was really cool. You know, those moments are rare that you have some, you know, something so relatable to a patient, but there's so many examples of how having taken care of my mom or helped take care of her, and then also having my own illness has made me a much better doctor.
How did that impact, like, seeing your mother and taking care of her and then your own illness? I know you said you provided a really good point that medicine is so different nowadays. You can have, there are so many treatments, but can you provide some perspective of being a child with a parent with a health condition?
It was, you know, she was really sick. Like, wheelchair bound is, you know, pretty devastating for a mom, you know, that has small children, devastating for the children also. So there was a lot of just kind of sadness of like watching, you know, this is in the 80s and early 90s, where like my friends would have their brown bag lunch, and they'd pull out like a note that their mom had written, like, have a good day at school. And I was like, oh man, like I'm getting hot lunch because my mom can't make me lunch, you know, just really childish things like that. But, you know, they were sad for a kid, and to not have my mom be able to like supervise a field trip, for example, just things like that, that I felt, you know, sad about. And then I think something that helps me relate to the patient's caregivers is how much work it is to have somebody that's wheelchair bound or, you know, in a similar situation, because it is, it's an insane amount of work, 24 hours a day. You know, getting, you know, in-home healthcare is extremely expensive. It's not accessible to most people. So just being able to, I can now relate when the caregivers bring their loved one in and I'm like, are you getting rest? Like, do you have any days off? And just being able to talk to them and tell them like, you're doing a really, really good job has been nice to watch. And I wouldn't have that perspective if I hadn't seen how much work it is firsthand.
I'm so glad you mentioned that about being a caregiver, because it is a lot, and it's something that's not, there's not a lot of light that's shed upon it, but it is a very common throughout society of taking care of parents as they grow older, and like the shift of roles in that sense, all that has to be done to take care of a family member. I know you are also a dean. How is then that new role now in the academics? How is that, or has it changed how you relate with other students? Yeah, I would love to hear just that other perspective of being in medicine.
Sure. So at Wayne State, I'm the Associate Dean of Graduate Medical Education. Mm. So I oversee all of Wayne State's residency programs. So outside of emergency medicine, you know, that job has its own tasks that any dean of graduate medical education has to deal with. But because I have this interest in disability and inclusion, it has given me a platform where I can say, all right, you know, what we're going to do is when we send out invitations to interview potential residents, you know, it's fourth year of med school and we're sending out invitations. I want every program director's invitation to have a paragraph about, we welcome people with disabilities and here's how you would access resources and information at Wayne State and how you would request accommodations. So we do that now on our application, our interview, you know, like you're invited to interview. We put it on our welcome letter after match when we know exactly which students are coming to us. And then we talk about it during orientation. So just making sure that people understand how to access accommodations and that we are a welcoming environment. And then I've gotten to work with Dr. Lisa Meeks, who's at University of Michigan, who's a real leader in the field. And we're partnering with the ACGME, which is the Accreditation Council for GME, to work on some resources that nationally everyone could use. And so I think if I wasn't in this position, I wouldn't be able to have that influence. So it's kind of like using your power for good and not evil. So that's what I'm trying to do, at least with disability. And I don't want it at the exclusion of other DEI efforts. It's additive. It's not in place of. But I think that disability gets sort of forgotten. So we make sure that we do not forget disability.
Thank you. Especially as being a fourth year myself, of going through not waiting for match, but then looking at all the residencies, it's hard to find information to see if residencies or if programs are inclusive. Is there any last suggestions you have for individuals who are like me looking at universities or looking at programs to see if they are inclusive of disabilities, besides being like very direct and asking?
Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations or
advice? Think just, you know, going to their GME, essentially any institution is going to have, even if they're not university affiliated, is going to have a GME website that you could kind of go through their policies. You should absolutely look at their GME handbook, which in almost all cases is going to be publicly accessible, or you could certainly ask for it if it's not easy to find. I think the harder things are to find, that potentially could be a little bit of a red flag. Like, why am I having such a hard time figuring out what your policies are on disability or parental leave or, you know, whatever. So if you encounter a program that has these things very front and center and easily accessible and in black and white, I think that would be a good sign. I'm not saying that the program's bad if it's not easily accessible. It would give me pause as to why that information isn't so readily available.
That is a really helpful tidbit, so thank you. I'm currently working on an article and blog post about how to disclose to residencies as I've gone through that process myself, and I did decide to disclose, and I feel like it was very difficult to find information on it. So it's really good to hear the GME's perspective and how there are individual advocates and people trying to also fix it on that level. So thank you so much for the advocacy work you're doing. Sure. To finish off the podcast, is there any last advice or any other notes that you would like to say or advice you would like to provide to the listeners?
Yeah, the last thing that I would say for all listeners, whether or not you have any diagnoses, please get disability insurance. Get it when you're young. I was able as a resident to get disability insurance that's portable, that can come with me to any job. No medical exam was required because, you know, you're in your 20s, so they presume everyone's healthy. So just protecting yourself. My mom could not get disability insurance because they didn't have, back then in the 70s, they didn't have policies that didn't require a medical exam. And disability insurance is so much more important than any other insurance, than life insurance. My dad used to say this when I was growing up, and I thought it was kind of crass, but he said, dying isn't very expensive. You know, you die, you have your life insurance policy, that's fine. Being chronically ill for years is extremely expensive. So just making sure that you have that peace of mind. So right now I have, I don't know, 4 different policies because you can add them together. So each job that I've gone to has come with a disability policy that's portable. So I just keep adding them together. So that's probably the most important, like, real life advice I could give, is just to make sure that you and your family is covered financially if you needed to take disability.
That is very, very helpful. Is that something that only pays out if you have to stop working entirely? Or what are the kinds of policies that are normally out there?
That is an excellent question. So if you are able, and this is pretty standard, you want to get a policy that's called own specialty. So my policies are specific to me being an ER doctor. So if I can't practice emergency medicine, then I qualify for disability. I could still keep my job in the dean's office. That's fine. So you could still have income and still collect disability if you cannot do your own profession. I had a colleague who was not able to to work in the emergency department because he lost his ability to intubate. He had some hand problems, but he could still work as an observation medicine doctor. So he was able to collect disability, but still be a physician. But because it was not his own specialty, he was able to collect disability. So that's, own specialty is kind of the buzzword you want to look for, so that it still gives you the opportunity, because you're still, as a physician, you're still going to have lots and lots of marketable skills, even if you can't do your clinical practice. So you want to make sure you're covered.
Do you know if there's even for like part-time? Because I know that some even medical schools provide it for if you need to take leaves of absences for short periods of time. Does that similarly exist, or only like for a long term?
Yeah, there's 2 types of policies. There's short-term disability and long-term disability. When I was having my kids, I had one kid during residency and one my first year as an attending. I had to take short-term disability, as if giving birth was a disability. But short-term disability kicks in within a few weeks of you being out of work. Long-term disability usually takes 3 to 6 months to kick in. So it's not helpful for, you know, something where you're going to be out for a little while. Let's say you break your leg or something, and then you're back, you know, 3 or 6 months later. Short-term disability, you know, it's good. I have a policy with my work that just comes with the work, but it's not by definition really what I'm more interested in. Like you should hopefully financially you plan so that if you needed to take some months off without income, you wouldn't be, you know, not paying your mortgage, for example. Should have a little bit of extra money in the bank account if possible.
Definitely. I know that was my personal challenge, is when I took my leave of absence, I took it for health condition. And because I had never heard of any type of short-term disability and my specific medical school didn't offer it, it was very, very financially difficult. But I have, as I've started researching, I've heard of some medical schools that do provide it, short-term disability, for that reason. So I started thinking of, like, for residency, is that something that you've seen is a benefit? I don't know if it's a required benefit or something you have to get outside.
That's a really good question. I believe, I'm not positive, don't quote me on it, I think Wayne State has short-term disability for the employees, because the residents are considered Wayne State employees, so they have the same benefits as everyone else. I'm a Wayne State employee as well, and I know that I do have some short-term disability through the university. That would be another good thing to look into, and especially when our rank lists due pretty soon, a couple weeks, maybe something to consider.
No, that is helpful. I'll definitely add that in as an important additional benefit to look for is disability. So thank you so much for taking some time to explain that. That was something that I haven't found anyone to talk about that specific. So that is extremely helpful. So thank you so much. I'm just going to do a quick recap of all the amazing things you said. You talked about kind of your growth, growing up with a PhD dad, an OB-GYN mother who was able to work for only about a decade before having to step away from her job, being wheelchair bound. But even then, it didn't stop you. It actually encouraged you from going into medicine. Throughout your entire journey, you kept, as you were only 16 when you were first diagnosed in high school, it was taught in the family, taught in society to keep it to yourself. And you were able to guard that secret close to you for your majority of your educational medical career, but were able to actually once more recently, you said 2020? Only a couple of years ago, we're able to take time to address your health and find the courage to disclose to the community. And you were met with support and you've now turned into an advocate to improve DEI and inclusivity for individuals going into residency who have disabilities and kind of include that as part of the efforts of diversity. And we talked about how important it is to look into disability insurance because you never know if you don't need accommodations now, you don't know if in the future you might get to a point where you can't do your current job. And so it's important to see beforehand what your individual job does offer. And you recommended doing the own specialty if you're in medicine. So you can still keep being a doctor. We have so many skills being physicians from our education and from learning. You also talked about the amount of empathy and compassion for patient experience through your own individual experience, going through dealing with meds, specialty pharmacies, and now providing more grace to other patients who also struggle with trying to afford and get a hold of their medications. I want to thank you, Dr. Messman, so much for coming in and sharing your experience. If anyone would like to get in contact with you, is there a way that they can or learn more about you?
I'm pretty easy to find online. My email's also easily available, amessman@med.wayne.edu, and you're free to post that. But yeah, I wanted to thank you so much. I was looking at your website this morning and the work that you're doing is incredible. And I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to my husband. He was the impetus behind me in 2020. He was like, you need to disclose. You're going to help people. You know, it's not just about me. It's about kind of being vulnerable and now being able to do things like your podcast. So I appreciate him and I appreciate you and all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And that is so important to have that support person because I can't imagine you would be here without his support and without the family members that have supported you throughout your journey, both non-disclosure and disclosure supporting. And it's so important to have someone. I'm the same way. I wouldn't have been able to disclose myself and be as confident in the disclosure if I didn't also have my husband that has been fully backing me and supporting me as the journey continues. So thank you. I appreciate that. And quickly, if you would like to learn more, want to contact Dr. Messman, I'll put the email in the chat. I'll also put my site, medpsychmoss@gmail.com. That's how you get in contact with me. My website, medpsychmoss.com. As I go through my own journey, as I talk to all these amazing physicians and health professionals, and they provide resources, I include that on the website through the blog or through resources. to help my own memory of all these resources, but also to help others. So thank you so much for joining us on this journey. And I always like to finish by just saying, like, you're not alone. If you're struggling, that's the whole reason why we share these stories, is to remind people that you don't have to struggle alone. There are other people who have gone through this journey, have struggled themselves, but have been able to keep going. And so just that message of hope that it does get better and that you're not alone. So thank you so much for walking alongside me and Dr. Mesman on our journeys as both patients and doctors. Thank you, Dr. Mesman. We'll see you next time.